Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
To me, it's just about fairness, and it's about stopping the measurement of success by how much money we have and start measuring success by how healthy our communities and how healthy is our natural environment.
Author and entrepreneur Judy Wicks talks about running a restaurant that's more about building relationships than it is about making money. Local food meets tech, a story from Colorado from Harvest Public Media. We meet farmer and kettle corn purveyor Chris Vosters in the second half of our show, why she's planning to pop corn until the very end. And our recipe today comes from Chef Bob Atkins. He's cooking up some miso salmon to be included in crispy croquettes. Food banks, food hubs, and fast food made our headlines this week with Lou Ann Johnson.
McDonald's reported a decline in same-store sales from last November to the tune of almost 5%. This month's numbers mark a 13-month consecutive decline in sales for the fast food giant. McDonald's took a hit globally after a Chinese chicken supplier scandal earlier this year, and locations in Russia are under investigation by consumer safety officials. A combination of misunderstood demand and ineffective marketing have sent the company's profits tumbling. Fast casual restaurants like Chipotle and Panera are growing. In response, McDonald's has increased custom offerings, which take more time to prepare. It is also raising prices on old standards like the Big Mac. Louisville, Kentucky will soon be home to one of the largest and most ambitious food hubs in the country. A 24-acre facility that organizers hope will serve as an example to spread across the region. The site sits on a vacant lot that was once a thriving National Tobacco Company plant. Now it is the center of a USDA-certified food desert where there is little access to fresh produce. Earlier this year, the city sold the lot to a nonprofit developer with plans to turn the site into a commercial agriculture park that will include trucking and storage for produce, a juicery and a 2-acre demonstration farm, and even a $20 million composting power plant to turn waste into methane energy. A Louisville local food demand analysis survey in 2012 indicated city residents would double their spending on local food if those products were readily available. After the methane plant breaks ground next spring, the park will follow with new construction in the fall of 2015, with plans to become operational by fall of 2016. And a year after cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food banks are still reeling from additional need for food assistance. In New York City, 40% of SNAP recipients rely also on food bank support. After across-the-board cuts last November, that demand has risen. Rural communities like Teton County, Montana, are seeing an increase in food assistance as low wages, fixed incomes, and SNAP cuts combine to cause food to not stretch as far as it did a year ago. Thanks to our reporters Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie for these stories. Share them with your friends. The links are at eartheats.org.
If you do the Twitter thing, find us at Earth Eats for lots of food and farm news throughout the week. Once a week, we hear from Lou Ann Johnson. Thanks.
Till next time, Annie.
Okay, so what we're going to make are sticky rice and salmon croquettes.
Long-time Earth Eats listeners may recognize that voice. Our friend Chef Bob Atkins is in the kitchen today. He'll be with us all show putting together this dish. Excited to hear what he has in store for us today. Take a listen.
So it's a three-step process. First thing we're going to do is we're going to poach the salmon in a kind of a wide, shallow pan. To this, we're going to add a half gallon of water. To that half gallon of water, we're going to add some white miso paste. Basically, we're making a stock or a broth. You see, you know, chicken base or beef base at the store, or that you add to water or bouillon cubes. It's the same process. We are boiling, and so immediately after it boils, bring it down to a simmer because I don't like to boil things. Really, only two things you should boil are green vegetables and pastas. Outside of that, everything else is done at a simmer. We're going to add our salmon, which has been trimmed down into manageable size pieces that will fit into the pan. We're just going to put them in the simmering broth. It's been deboned. The skin is still on it. I could skin it, but there's really no need to take the skin off. There's a lot of flavor in the skin. So for about 3 minutes, they've been simmering on one side.
Just flipping them over very carefully.
Flip them over. We're going to let this go about another 3 to 4 minutes. And then we're going to turn the heat off, let them rest in the liquid. That'll finish that last bit of cooking, that carryover heat. But also it allows it to absorb the moisture and the flavor from the miso broth that is going to give you a nice, moist, and flavorful final product.
Don't be afraid to have salmon that's medium on the inside. We'll be frying these croquettes before serving, so there's an extra bit of cooking that's going to happen later on. All right, we'll let Chef Bob do a bit more cooking on these and touch base with him again a little later. More cities want to take eating local food from just a hip trend to an economic generator. But as with many grassroots movements, there can be some growing pains along the way. That has some looking to the tech sector for lessons. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
When you talk about the local food movement to an economist or an economic development team, you're likely to hear the phrase cute to scale. That means up until this point, a lot of the movement has focused on the cute, bucolic farmers markets and high-priced farm-to-table restaurants, leaving the back-end stuff, like distribution and processing, untouched.
It's great to be able to do all that farm-to-table stuff, but now let's figure out how we make it impactful.
That's one of those economic development folks, Josh Burks, economic health director with the city of Fort Collins, Colorado. He wants the city to help make local food more accessible, and he wants it to add jobs and tax revenue to the local economy. To do that, Burks's department is supplying seed money for something called an industry cluster. These clusters help business owners share ideas and facilitate planning. They're part policy council, part think tank, part task force, and part trade association.
We're taking a concept that I think has been successful in more traditional industry areas like technology apps or the renewable energy space, and we're trying to apply it to something that is very, very different, a food system.
And because it's very different, forming a food cluster comes with a unique set of challenges.
You know, what I think the cluster wants to do is help organizations like yours stay afloat.
And so, I guess it just hasn't been conveyed enough how you guys are going to be doing.
Well, at an indoor winter farmers market, Ashley Colpart tries to sell the newly formed Northern Colorado food cluster to a prospective member. Colpart is the cluster's coordinator.
Part of the purpose of the cluster is to have dialogue that maybe wouldn't have been had before and talk about the constraints in the food system, but also the opportunities.
Colpart says one of the biggest challenges in growing a food system is lack of communication. Farmers who run small operations rarely have the time to network, and bigger companies don't see the benefit in working with smaller entities. That leads to a food system where only the big companies talk with each other, and vice versa for the small guys, leaving the crucial connections in the middle absent and unformed.
And a lot of the constraints on agriculture is who controls the middle parts of the distribution chain and the processing and manufacturing. All of that's happening by very large companies that are controlling prices and access points.
I don't know that the average person really cares about aggregating and moving produce in big trucks.
Diana Sokolov is with San Francisco's planning department. The city also has a food cluster.
It's kind of an ugly back-end side of the business.
Sokolov says there's real passion for local food, but few people are thinking about the middle, how to make it more profitable for farmers and more accessible for shoppers. That's where cities can come in to identify and fortify clusters. Becca Jablonski is an agricultural economist at Colorado State University.
So I think having some kind of organization that's helping to bring together different constituents who are, you know, all part of the same food system and helping to think through different kinds of opportunities at any scale is really important.
Jablonski says city officials have a vested interest in seeing local food take off to support jobs and feed people. Other local food clusters in cities like Louisville, Kentucky, and Portland, Oregon are also taking shape. But Jablonski says getting the local food movement away from just being cute could mean a shift in what the word local even means.
You know, is it just farms that sell at farmers markets directly to customers that are considered part of the local food system, or are we talking about something much more broad? And I would actually argue that that broader definition is much more useful.
And that broader definition includes the cute parts of the local food system and the businesses that aren't. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Food and farm stories from Harvest Public Media on their website. That's harvestpublicmedia.org. When Judy Wicks opened her restaurant, White Dog Cafe, in 1983 in Philadelphia, she'd never heard of fair trade or sustainability. She learned about these things as she went along, as she describes in her book, Good Morning, Beautiful Business. The decisions she made in those early days weren't informed by trends. It was about doing right by the people around her. As a small business owner, she saw firsthand how her choices affected her customers, her neighbors, and her employees. Like when she was deciding how much to pay entry-level dishwashers.
I was in the kitchen one time, and three young men who were making below the living wage happened to look up at me at once, and the light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, of course I want anyone who works, you know, 40 hours a week full-time at the White Dog to be able to pay their rent and buy their food and their clothes and so on. So, of course, I want to pay a living wage.
A choice like that cut into the profits of the restaurant. But that was okay for Wicks. Her goal from the very beginning was to maximize relationships, not to maximize profits. White Dog also started offering local food purchased from area farmers in 1986. That was long before the food movement became a national craze.
And in doing so, I think I had a financially successful business because I really focused on the relationships with the employees and the customers and my suppliers and so on, and that ends up with long-term financial sustainability as well. And, you know, to me it's just about fairness, and it's about stopping the measurement of success by how much money we have and start measuring success by how healthy are our communities and how healthy is our natural environment.
She traces these ideas back to her time living in an Eskimo village.
People had no concept of taking more than they needed. They had no concept of accumulating, more stuff than they needed to get by on. And they were about sharing and cooperation. And that really had a big influence on me. And they were the happiest people I've ever met because their security did not depend on money. Their security was dependent on community. So I think we need kind of a sea change in our culture and in our economy to value people and place and animals and nature more than we value money.
We'll hear more from Judy Wicks in a couple minutes. Then the origin story of one family's kettle corn business.
This is a way that we can make this go. This is a way we can specialize for the family farm. So basically that's how we got into it, and it never intended to grow into what it is today.
Farmer Chris Vosters talks about kettle corn, family, and living through personal tragedy. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hello, it's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in today.
One of the things that our farmers are doing is heating the greenhouses with used fry oil from the restaurants.
Restaurateur and author Judy Wicks. Her relationship with local farmers isn't just about cash exchanged for veggies. She gives a waste product from her kitchen to her growers, and they use that as fuel.
So this is an economical way to heat greenhouses in the winter, which really makes growing more vegetables possible, because one of the challenges had been the cost of heat. But with free heat from the vegetable oil, the biodiesel, this has created more year-round farming under greenhouses.
Which in turn gets more local food on the menu more of the year. In my conversation with Judy, she talked a lot about balance, profits versus relationships, what you need versus what you want, and the balance of masculine and feminine energies in the world of food.
One of our farmers said that he feels that good farming is a balance between the masculine and the feminine, and he sees the masculine as being efficiency and the feminine as being nurturing. And the factory farming is kind of the worst example of masculine energy totally dominating, so that it's all about efficiency. It's all about, you know, wringing every last penny out of the animals and the land and the workers and so on, with almost no nurturing whatsoever. So we need to have that back in balance.
Judy Wicks is the founder of White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia, and she's also the recipient of the James Beard Foundation's Humanitarian of the Year back in 2005. Her book is Good Morning, Beautiful Business, The Unexpected Journey of an Activist Entrepreneur and Local Economy Pioneer. A visit now to the farmer's market. Vendor and farmer Chris Vosters sells kettle corn at the market every Saturday morning. As Chris tells student producer Kale Wilk, her business has been the one constant throughout a life of changes.
That's the sound of kettle corn popping. It's like popcorn, except the kernels are popped in an oiled kettle and given sugar rather than salt. Right now we're at a place that some might say is pretty poppin' itself. The Bloomington, Indiana Farmers Market.
Be careful, it's hot yet.
That's Chris Vosters. She's a 56-year-old kettle corn farmer north of Odin, Indiana.
I was daddy's boy. They had no other boy, so I grew up doing the farming thing. It's always been my background. It's been my passion.
When the season comes around, Chris looks forward to her weekend trips to Bloomington. She puts on an old dress and apron that makes her look like someone from the early 20th century. Kettle corn has some of its roots during the Great Depression when sugar was rationed. While her son-in-law Steve cooks the corn in the back of their booth, Chris sells it up front.
Don't have that side.
Be careful, it's hot, yeah?
I eat corn.
You do? I just don't want you to get burnt, buddy.
Well, I put on that old dress, I can be anything. You know, they don't know who I am or what I am. I can be anybody. I tried to treat everybody the same, and that's what's so neat about it, because I deal with them all, you know, from professors up there at IU to doctors to lawyers to the guy that works for the Walmart or the guy that flips cheeseburgers. I mean, all of them's my customers, and especially market. You know, a lot of people, I don't know the name, but I know the face and what they like and what they don't like, and it's more of a, I don't know, a relationship with them.
She inherited the farm and business from her parents. But the family business wasn't always kettle corn. It started as cornmeal and livestock. And then someone gave her parents and husband a playful suggestion.
My parents went to Florida in the wintertime.
It was 1998.
And there was a family they met at the Florida State Fair that had a kettle corn operation.
They were the Brunkies from Missouri. They became friends, but
this man, he was always trying to sell my husband a kettle corn operation. You know, he was trying to marketing a kettle and first one thing and then two. And
Brunke shows them how to do it as long as they stay out of a local show and out of Missouri.
So my husband came home and him and my dad welded up the first winter and, you know, just kind of a dare challenge thing. And
so they play around with the kettle corn rig, serve some people at a local show and decide,
This is a way that we can make this go. This is the way we can specialized for the family farm. So basically that's how we got into it. It was a dare to build a kettle amongst two friends, and it never intended to grow into what it is today.
I asked Chris to show me around her farm to see all that was there.
That's a combine in there.
There's her house, her daughter's house, and two main sheds with farming vehicles and equipment.
And then what is this over here that we're walking up to?
This is the original family farm. The house was built in 1875. It was homesteaded then. My parents bought it in 1958. This is where I grew up.
Chris sometimes receives help from family, but...
I'm pretty much a loner. It's just me. I take care of one person, that's me. And the dog, of course. That's a dog. Yeah, she's a good dog. She's a best friend, aren't you, Autumn? Speak. Can you speak?
Oh, my goodness.
There are fewer people on the farm these days. Chris's father died in 2002. Her husband died in 2010. Then her mother died 2 years ago.
You want your parents to live in long, healthy, happy life, and your husband and the whole nine yards, but that's not the card I got dealt. I got dealt a three, and if I got dealt a three, I can't play an ace or a king. So, I just deal with it. I wish they were all here, and I'm sure that everybody's lost anybody. They feel the same way. So go on. If I went back and sat in that house and sat in that chair, I'd die. So that's how I deal with all the death, all the sadness, all the things is keep busy, because when I'm working, I'm not thinking.
Chris's work helps her pay the bills. It even helped get her kids through college. But they've all moved on with their lives. For Chris, this is her way of life. On the farm, she can't escape the memories of her loved ones. They inform everything she does.
Live like you're dying, because you are. You just don't realize it. And I try to do something fun every day. Just a little bit.
Would you have rather had it any other way?
No. No, when my husband retired, he told me, he says, I got one move. I'll take you anywhere in the world you want to go. You want Bahamas, you want Antigua, you want California. I said, you just take me on home till Daddy dies. When he died in 02, I asked my husband, I said, now do you want to go somewhere else? And he said, nope. He said, we're just fine right here. So I wouldn't live any different.
And that means cooking more kettle corn. I asked Chris how long she expects to keep doing it.
How long am I going to cook corn? I can't cook corn no more. What else am I going to do? I can get a real job. Do I really want a real job? Probably not. So... as long as I'm physically able to do it, I'll probably cook a little corn.
For Earth Eats, I'm Cale Wilk.
This story is a collaboration with Earth Eats and the Indiana University School of Journalism. See a picture of Chris Vosters serving up kettle corn at eartheats.org. Now with Chef Bob Atkins to see him finish up our salmon croquettes. He completed the mundane task of cooking rice since we last heard from him. Let's see how his recipe for rice compares to how you cook rice. To 4 cups of arborio rice, he adds 11 cups of boiling water, turning down the heat to a simmer, cover it, cook it for 10 minutes. There was still liquid in the pot, he said, which was actually a good thing. He let the rice sit in there for an additional 15 minutes or so the rice could absorb all that starch. And we need that starch for this recipe, so everything sticks together like it should. I'll put these rice cooking instructions on our website for you to follow. That's eartheats.org. Okay, here's Bob.
So I have here approximately 10 to 12 cups of cooked rice. To that, we're going to add our salmon in a minute, but first we're going to add our complementary ingredients to the rice. So have here a good amount of garlic, the red chili flakes, give it some color, give it a little bit of heat, fresh lemon zest brunoise, a little bit unorthodox, but not really when it comes to fish, some fresh chopped dill. To this, we're going to add 1/2 cup of toasted sesame seeds. You want to toast the sesame seeds until they actually start to turn brown. They should be fragrant, and they'll actually start to pop like popcorn. That's going to really give the depth to it. And then sesame oil, It's going to add some fat to it. It's going to add some luxuriousness to it. And also a nice sesame oil. It just fills up with the aroma. So with the dill and the sesame and the garlic and the miso, lots of really nice bright aroma going on. So we have all this here. You could use a spatula. I'm going to use some rubber gloves. Your hands are probably the most gentle mixing tools there are. And I'm really not crushing anything. I'm really trying to separate the grains of rice here. And now we have nice poached salmon. And there's still, it's still just a little bit, it's a nice medium on the inside, which is exactly where you want it. It's still going to flake apart. And just very kind of gingerly fold the rice around the salmon, breaking up the bigger chunks as I go along, but not too much. Too often when you get cakes or croquettes, the special ingredient gets so shredded and so dispersed that you have a hard time actually seeing it or defining it in each bite. At this point, we've got a big bowl of salmon and sticky rice. I'm just now forming it into little balls, and I'm going to flatten them out into kind of a disc or lentil type shape. The idea is to have a nice, moist, final croquette so that it's crispy on the outside but creamy and fluffy on the inside. That's why we left the rice in the water to absorb it. That's why we left the salmon in the liquid to absorb that liquid.
Now for the frying. If you don't have a restaurant-grade fryer in your home kitchen, you can just grab a cast iron skillet, add about 3/4 of an inch of oil, and fry these little discs for a few minutes on each side.
So I'm just going to gingerly remove these. I'm just going to drain them for a second on some paper towels. And then we've made a glaze out of sweet soy sauce, which is a thickened soy sauce, wasabi paste, some miso, nice thick pungent sauce to finish, then a little toasted sesame seed over the top. And that's the salmon croquettes. Get them while they're hot and enjoy.
Thank you so much to Chef Bob Atkins for making this for us today. He's a very creative guy. Find this and other recipes of his, like his liver and onions tacos. What? That's at eartheats.org. Hungry and curious crew at Earth Eats includes Bob Atkins, Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Casey Zakin, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Earth Eats, done for another week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Annie Corrigan.